Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to The Art Detective with me, Dr. Yanina Ramirez. I'm an Oxford art historian, a broadcaster and a writer, and I'm your chief investigator of images. Happy day today for me. I'm joined by dear friend, drinking buddy, Rebecca Riddell. And I, how can I describe you? You are so many things. You are a writer, a former television producer, and you're doing your PhD. You're completing it at the moment, aren't you, at Royal Holloway?
I am indeed, yes.
But you also blog, you're amazing on Twitter, you pop up on my screens all the time. It's a diverse life you lead, isn't it?
Well, interesting.
Interesting life. But we're here today because I asked you to come in. You've written this wonderful book, 1666. And full title?
1666, Plague, War and Hellfire. But I promise it's more cheerful than it sounds.
It does sound rather depressing, the three big ones.
Yeah, well, hit them with them all.
But it's a great book. And so your research mainly is on 17th century, in particular around that pivotal, cataclysmic year, 1666. So much happened then, didn't it?
Yeah, Charles II was restored to the throne in 1660. Everything was going great for a few years. And then, bam, it all kind of fell apart. England went to war with the Dutch, who were this huge maritime nation at the time, and the plague hit the capital city. And then obviously we know in 1666, the Great Fire of London kind of, you know, was the last of these awful things to happen. Actually, that's a lie. It wasn't the last. There was the raid on the Medway in 1667 as well.
Oh, God. So, yeah, it sort of was a very traumatic year, particularly for London. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, because I'm a gothy medievalist who loves sort of these images of memento mori and suffering and pain. We're doing plague. And we've got a couple of plague images that we're going to talk about. But we're going to talk about 1666 at length, 65-66. But you've brought along another image, which I recognise from your book. Tell me a bit about this one we're looking at.
It's an image that appeared on a pamphlet written by Thomas Dekker in 1625. It was published by a London publisher called John Trundle. And it shows a skeleton kind of astride four coffins. And you can see devastation all around this skeleton. People are fleeing out of London. People are dead on... probably looks a bit like hay bales.
It does look like a haystack, doesn't it?
Yeah, there's coffins everywhere. And then you can see the City of London in the background. And above that, a big storm cloud just to add to the atmosphere. And written on the image are the words, "Lord have mercy on London. I follow," as in the skeleton. "We fly," the people running away. "We die," the people that are dead. And then just, you know, to drum home the devastation, "Keep out" at the end. So this appeared during a plague, which was actually the biggest plague to that point, up until that point, in 1625. And this was kind of tapping into this lust, I suppose, for these types of images and to kind of visualise the chaos that so many people had experienced in London. But I just think it's a really exciting image because it really does show the fear that would have been rife within the city at that time.
And it's a printed image. That's something we should also probably mention. It's going to be on a leaflet. Is this a leaflet then that's being given out for, as you suggest, sort of like this almost sort of gory titillation of the scene, or the fact that it says keep out, is it actually a practical instructive manual?
It's many, many things. And the fact that it appeared on a pamphlet by Thomas Dekker is interesting, because actually what you, and obviously we'll come back to the Great Plague of 1665, but the difference between the literature in 1665, and this could just be a coincidence, the people that were alive at the time, but Thomas Dekker was quite satirical. So he and people like Ben Jonson in during the earlier plagues in the 1603, 1604, etc., they wrote satirical pieces of work about the plague. Thomas Dekker in another pamphlet actually said that laughter would be a good remedy to plague,
oh, wow.
Which I think is quite nice, actually, because if you think about awful events that happen in the world, what people often want is just to be cheered up a little bit. And I guess that's what they were doing with the satire. Ben Jonson did a similar thing in a play called The Alchemist that was released in the early 1600s. His daughter actually... son died from plague. So that's, the mood is very different in the early 17th century, although obviously the consequences of plague are very similar.
So we can see it as satire. That's really, really interesting. So, it's obviously attempting to set it within a recognisable landscape. You can see major monuments from London in the background. But in terms of the central figure, that skeleton is very dramatic, but in a way it is quite funny.
It is. I mean, the pamphlet was by a satirical writer, but also, you know, he's famous for having written many, many plague pamphlets as well. But there is a warning there as well. This was a deeply religious society, so implicit in anything like this is the fear of holy retributions for sins that people have committed. And it's part of that as well, that, you know, this is God's punishment in a way. And that's a theme that we see throughout the 17th century as well, that death is here to take away those that may have sinned, or as a kind of punishment, I suppose.
And is that what's going on this far right corner? Because you've got the people fleeing, and they look like they're fleeing into weapons or some sort of obstruction there. Is it almost that they're between a rock and a hard place, you know, that they're between war and plague almost?
Yeah, well, they want to leave the city, but I mean, obviously we know that plague, it says there, I follow, we fly, and plague will be following them. And we know that whenever there's an outbreak in the capital city, it does tend to flow out of the capital to all of the cities that are connected through roadways and also port cities as well. So leaving the city obviously would have increased somebody's chances of remaining alive, but not necessarily.
And let's just be a bit explicit about what we're talking about in terms of plague. Are we talking bubonic plague? Is this rat carried plague?
Oh, that's the big question. I've answered this before, and actually I'm going to stick with it. If anybody tells you 100% that they know exactly what the plague was in the 17th century, don't believe them, because we cannot know with 100% certainty. There have been some really amazing discoveries during excavations at the new Crossrail site at Liverpool Street. So they uncovered many, many skeletons, and they found some skeletons that looked as though they'd been buried in a... Well, they were buried in a mass grave. So they extracted, they removed some of the teeth from these skeletons, because, I mean, I'm not a scientist, so people listening will probably be like, no, she's wrong. But they extracted the DNA, mitochondrial DNA.
Very good. See, I know that. From biology A level, I know.
There you go. It must be right.
Yeah.
And they found the presence of Yersinia pestis, which is the plague bacterium, within these skeletons.
Gosh, how exciting.
It is really exciting, but still there are, I mean, I'm definitely not downplaying the amazing discovery that this is. It shows that people buried in a mass pit in the 17th century had Yersinia pestis in their system. Was that the thing that killed them? Did everybody have Yersinia pestis? Was that the cause of all plague? Who knows? I personally, and this is an opinion, subscribe to the mainstream view that it was bubonic plague predominantly, with pneumonic plague as well. And bubonic plague is spread usually by rats, rodents, and, well, fleas on rodents, and then the fleas, once they've had their fill of the rodents or the rodents have died, they jump onto humans then and suck their blood. But as they're doing that, they find when fleas have Yersinia pestis, when they have this bacterium, it's hard for them to actually suck blood out of hosts.
Oh, right.
So it encourages...
I hope you're not having a dinner, anybody.
Yeah, sorry. It's actually really, really gross. So what it does, it encourages the flea to gag, I suppose, and it regurgitates this bacterium into the bite wound, and then the toxins infiltrate the body, and then the person is infected.
I did not know that. It is disgusting and interesting.
I know.
But so that's really interesting. So we're looking at a selection of possible bubonics, plague that's infecting, but it's very contagious, and it's cross in a place like London. It's easy to contaminate because people are living in close proximity. Is it, what we see in medieval images of the Black Death, for example, is that it's indiscriminate. It attacks everybody across all the classes. Is that what we see in London, or is it more localised? Do we see particular areas being worse hit than others?
Again, another really good question. I think if all things were equal, it could attack anybody. But poverty and the concentration of houses in certain areas does tend to mean that plague during the 17th century, and indeed before that point, tends to affect the poorer people or those living in the very, very tightly packed urban areas. And this does change actually throughout the century. So in 1665, what we see is that... the plague starts in St Giles in the fields and spreads around outside of the city.
Because what we're looking at in this image is presumably on the outskirts. You know, there's a suggestion of countryside, of haystacks, all the rest of it. So this is out on the outskirts, isn't it?
Yeah, this is showing where people are leaving. They've tried to flee the city. Mm. But actually, during the early 1600s, it was actually places... Well, I mean, we're in Southwark right now. It was places like Southwark that were affected... more than other places. In fact, going back to Thomas Dekker and also Ben Jonson, they actually write explicitly about how actually within the city of London, so this is the walled area with it, you know, the main part of the metropolis, it's actually not too bad. People aren't really being affected by plague so much. It's these urban areas where people are more affected. The other factor, which I find really interesting, and this is based, so I will give due credit, this is based on research by Professor Justin Champion, is that throughout the 17th century, men, the margins here are tiny but important, men tend to die more than women from plague. But weirdly, in 1665, that's reversed, ever so subtly, but that's reversed. Now, we don't know why... you know, why this happens, whether, and we'll probably speak about the roles that women had potentially during the plague, but whether this is because more women were becoming nurses.
Having
nurses
contact with infected people. Yeah.
Or whether it's because women were staying in the home a bit more and they were, you know, more likely to contract plague, or whether it's because there was a greater number of men fleeing the city. We don't know. There's a range of theories, but that's the fact, really. And when I say these margins are tiny, they really are. So in 1665, it was 168 more people, women died than men during that plague.
Out of roughly how many in total, then?
In total, according to the bills of mortality, there were 68... 1,500 and I think 96.
Good grief.
It could be 86, but it's, you know, around 69,000. But we actually think that there was probably around 100,000 people that died from plague in London.
Yes, because, I mean, there'll be unrecorded, there'll be all sorts of things where the open pits were just used.
There's actually a really heartbreaking snippet of a story that is within a pamphlet written by a very cheerful man named Thomas Vincent, who wrote a pamphlet called God's Terrible Voice, when I say cheerful, I'm being ironic. But he wrote about seeing a woman carrying what he believed was the final child in her family within a tiny coffin and walking towards the new churchyard, which the new churchyard, as we, well, you may or may not know, is the site that was excavated during the Crossrail excavations, Liverpool Street. And he said he saw this woman doing that. So, yes, there would have been burials taking place of children that perhaps hadn't been baptised, but also people, non-conformists and people that didn't want to be buried within the church and that kind of thing.
But we also have a situation, presumably, of overcrowding within cemeteries. I mean, that's something we're going to go on to. Should we look at our next image? Because that really walks us through what's happening. So we've got 25. I think the thing to take away, I mean, that image is powerful. It's dramatic. It leaves an echo. You chose it for your book, presumably for those reasons. Yeah.
Yeah, I just think, I mean, aesthetically, it's quite a cool image, really, that skeleton on top of coffins. But it does kind of summarise. That's the plague image. I didn't choose a plague doctor because I haven't actually found any evidence, and someone, you know, people might disagree with me, that there were plague doctors wearing those beaked masks within London or indeed anywhere else in England in the 17th century. So.
How interesting. So, yeah, we might think of that frightful image of the sort of beaked nose. I think the skeleton's just as powerful.
I think so.
But the thing to take away, I suppose, is this idea that plague repeats. There aren't single instances and there are constant relapses. And when it comes in the sort of strength it did in 1625, it's very dramatic. It moves very quickly. Do we have repeated plagues between then and 65, or is this the next big one?
No, there's an outbreak in 16. The other thing to say, actually, really quickly, is that in 1625, the plague broke out just after the death of James the First and the Sixth of Scotland, and also the plague broke out in 1603, just after the death of Elizabeth, and this did not pass the public by. They did attach, you know, think of this as a kind of omen. So yes, there was 16.
Hang on, an omen then of the downfall of Protestant rulers, or
no, just an omen that the monarch has died, so the monarch will take swathes of people with them.
Wow, like an army! Yeah. Oh my goodness, it's like the Valkyries. I love thinking of Elizabeth like that. That's great. Oh, no, but of course, so there's going to be symbolism attached to all elements of the plague, aren't there?
Yeah.
Religious symbolism as well. Mm-hmm. That people have sinned, that they're being punished for sin, or that, you know, there's something corrupt in the city. So there were other further outbreaks, but they sort of coincide with these big events.
Yeah, but the other ones, there was one in 1736. There were outbreaks within you know, other areas outside of London. So my own hometown of Chester, there was an outbreak there in the 1640s and 50s as well. But also plague was endemic, so there were cases every single year across
Absolutely.
The country.
I mean, that's the thing. I think people, looking back across history, assume that the big ones is all that happens. No, there's constant threat of plague, of fever, of things that will wipe through a community and cause complete devastation. But 65 is big, isn't it? Why is 65 such an important plague?
It's important in hindsight because it's the last one, the last great outbreak. And before 1665, the Great Plague had been, the title The Great Plague had been attached to 1603 and also 1625 as well. But actually, in terms of numbers, it probably took the most amount of lives. Proportionally, perhaps not, though, because 1603, we think, was probably a bit more deadly. But there was estimates put the population of the capital at the time in 1665 at around 450 to 500,000, and it took 100,000 people.
Good grief, a quarter, one in four. I mean, that's almost Black Death proportions.
Yeah. It's part of the same pandemic as well, by the way. It's still this Black Death pandemic. It's the last stages of this. But what I always try to remind people is that, yes, there was, you know, one in four people died, but some people survived as well. So, the numbers aren't one in four suffered plague. The numbers are greater than that. And actually, those that didn't suffer plague would have known people that died from plague as well. So it affected everybody.
Well, this is it. It's about sensibilities changing as well, isn't it? And what we see, after the after the 14th century Black Death is that there's this sort of memento mori. There's a real fascination with death, with the omnipresence of death, and we get wonderful cadaver tombs coming in where you see people memorialized with bones and worms wriggling around inside them and all the rest of it. And it's almost like there is an emotional change in the climate, in the population, because people are suffering. Yeah. They've all known death and they've seen it and they've been affected by it. Do we see a similar thing happening from 65?
Yeah, we do. We see people feeling they begin to assess their own lives. Mm. Not everybody, but there are some high profile writers that write about how these events, and they do tie the events, and this is why I include all three in my book. Yeah. But they do tie the Anglo-Dutch War, the Great Fire of London, and the Great Plague together as three things that were punishments for a variety of sins, depending on who you were and what your beliefs were. It could be that you were being punished for the regicide of Charles I. It could be that London was being punished for the licentious court of Charles II. It could be a variety of reasons, but at the heart of all of them was this idea that London was being punished and people had done something wrong. And there was a genuine feeling of guilt as well. I mean, you find this in John Evelyn's diaries. You find it in Samuel Pepys's diaries to an extent. That they're always kind of like...
He's slightly less guilty and more interested in cheese.
He lived for the now. but... it does shift the feeling towards the court of Charles II as well, because, of course, Charles II fled the capital city when the number of plague dead reached a level that was scary, really.
So he abandoned the city, so there's a sense in which, you know, he's running off the field, isn't he?
Yeah, and also the city of London had always been this place beyond direct monarchical control. It was controlled by the livery companies, the aldermen, the mayor as well. So there's a really interesting dynamic, and this is beyond the scope of talking about plague really, but there's a very interesting dynamic between the City of London and the sitting monarch during the 17th century. But this is potentially why Charles II and his brother, James the Duke of York, were so active and made sure people were aware that they were active during the Great Fire of London, because they wanted to be seen to be saving people and saving that city, because they could potentially be accused of having not done that during the plague.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Gosh. I mean, there's so many different layers to this. There's the involvement of the church, presumably, as well. And we have to bring in all that political aspect. The thing we were sat in front of at the moment was the original image you wanted to talk about. I find it utterly fascinating. Do tell me what we're looking at.
This is part of a broadsheet, and it was created by John Dunstall, who is described in records as being a school teacher. He lived by the Strand, and he had made a number of etches and prints during, I don't know when he was born, we don't know when he was born, but he was active during the 1650s, and his prints had been images of wildlife and animals and things. But this print, There are 9 images altogether, and it shows the various stages of plague in London in 1665. So the first image, we see people in their sick beds, and interestingly, there's a very female-driven angle to that first plate that
we can get. Of course, I hadn't noticed that. There's lots of women in that.
So what you can see in that first image is, it's hard. You really do have to zoom in on these pictures, but you have two people in sick beds on either side of that first plate, and within the room, can you see? I mean, just looking at it, yeah. Do you see what?
Yes, you've got two beds, obviously draped. People, someone's sort of leaning out almost in agony. Then there's a number of things in the foreground: tables, chairs, implements on the table, and that looks like a woman with a walking stick, possibly. But there's definitely 1, 2, 3 women, it looks like, and a figure in the door frame at the back.
This is a very interesting representation of women during plague times. So you have two nurses in that room. You have two people that are dead. One person that's very sick, one person that has died. You have a coffin in there.
Oh, it's a coffin in the foreground. Yeah.
So you have two nurses. But also you have two searchers as well. Now, women would be the nurses. Women were always brought in to do that. And it was part of the plague orders that there would be two women that would take on that role. But then the searchers would be women as well. And these searchers were responsible for checking the corpses of the dead to see what they had actually died from. And they were known by having these they were supposed to be red or white rods that they walked around with, and you can actually see this rod or staff that one of the women is holding there. Now, I am a big, big fan of The Handmaid's Tale.
Mm.
And it was only through watching The Handmaid's Tale that I started to rethink the way that these relationships might have worked between these women. We know that, we know that many searchers worked together for a number of years. We know that in some parishes there was a high turnover. But the interesting thing about The Handmaid's Tale is that you see that people are walking around in pairs, and part of the reason they're doing it in pairs is that they can spy on one another and make sure that they're doing the work that they're supposed to be doing. So I think there's an element of that with these plague searchers as well, because they were very susceptible to bribery. There was lots of literature about how awful these women were. I don't think they all were awful, actually. I think this was a part of a kind of smear campaign.
It's a horrible job. And I mean, they're presumably having to... So they're having to record causes of death as plague in order for them to be buried accordingly. You mentioned that they're open to corruption. Is that... Say more, why?
Yeah, well, because if they go into one household and a person is found to have died of plague, the entire house will
be
shut
up. Yeah.
And everyone in it has to stay in there in quarantine for 4 weeks. For 40 days it is, not 4 weeks. They have to stay in quarantine for that amount of time, or until the last person is free from plague. So if somebody is found to have plague, then that's terrible. So they are susceptible for bribery. They could say that somebody had died from smallpox instead, or they could say that somebody had died from, you know, something else. But also they hold a lot of power because of this.
Yeah.
So I do think there have been a number of historians that have looked into the role of searchers. I do think there's a lot more that we can say about these women. Also, the other thing is, the key thing, in my view, is that they are the ones that harvested the data that any plague historian uses.
Oh, so
right,
it's
now
all filtered through these female hands and these potentially unknown, possibly corrupt female hands.
Yeah, and again, John Graunt is this statistician that is around during the formative years of the Royal Society. He writes about plague. He tracks the process of plague throughout the 17th century. And he says that searchers can't be trusted, which is quite frustrating, because he actually bases all of his data and research on their statistics.
And we're still doing so up to this point. But to have an image that captures that so well, I think that is absolutely amazing. And again, you know, I can come to it, say what I see, but you've brought all this depth to it by having the context. So the female aspect's really important in there. But actually, it's part of a sequence. I find this really interesting because it is almost comic book-like. You know, you're moving through stages, it's progressing. But there is an order to it. I think there's a chaos in the 1625 image of the skeleton. It's quite dramatic, it's quite chaotic. This has been structured very carefully to tell a story, hasn't it?
Yeah, and I also think it's a way of controlling this, the narrative of plague. So that's the first image. I won't spend as long on all the rest, but the next image, we see houses being shut up. And that's, I mean, everybody knows that that happened, and it did happen. Houses were shut up with a red mark on the front of the door.
And they looked like quite grand houses in this
Yeah, they
scene.
Do, I suppose. Mm. They do. They're... Most of London was kind of ramshackle. I mean, the suburbs of London was kind of ramshackle with lots of tenants living in bizarre places within a house. Like, you'd have a nice, orderly house, but then somebody would be living, like, on the side of it in a little shed, and that would be included in, you know, the house.
Yeah.
So, yeah, these houses do look quite orderly. But then if we moved on to the next one, we can see that people have evacuated the city. And you can see St. Paul's in the background there, without old St. Paul's, without its spire. It broke about 100 years before the Great Plague, actually. But you can see people in boats on the river. And I think this is something that doesn't get spoken about that much, actually. The fact that people were actually living on the river for a while because that was a way to keep out of the city. They believed that the city was infected. But if they were on the boats on the river, they were safe, which was obviously not true.
But so that they are partly in transit, partly kind of fleeing the city on the river, but also potentially there's the idea that they're actually kind of seeking sanctuary on the water itself.
And people did do that. And then you can actually see, talking about fleeing, you can see people fleeing the city and going to the country
and
as well.
And St. Paul's again in the background there. Yeah. So there's this sort of idea that it's chronologically and geographically giving you almost like a panorama of the city, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I suppose
very
that's
clever.
Right.
Yeah. And they're fleeing on land. And again, I mean... I suppose, to me, it looks quite orderly. They do. You know, they're not crowded compositions. They don't feel horrendously chaotic. Is that because this is retrospective? That this is something that's a document that it's supposed to be a controlled piece of evidence?
Well, it is a piece of evidence actually, because this image was it accompanies a pamphlet which details plague throughout the 17th century. So it's talking about the statistics, the mortality statistics throughout the 17th century. So it's to show, it is retrospective. It was printed in 1666. And there was a lot of material pumped out in 1666 about the plague of 1665. So yeah, it is. It's kind of a historic representation of the awful year that had preceded.
Right.
But, yeah, so then you move on. There's various images of people fleeing, but then also we've got depictions of people carrying coffins with their dead inside.
OK, so there's a narrative going on here, isn't there? In the first one, you've got the actual death beds. You've got the people being bricked up, walled in for their... because the illness has to incubate, has to go run through the household. Then you've got this idea of people fleeing, trying to get away from it before it gets them. And then you've got the poor unfortunates that have been got, haven't you? And then there's this sequence of sort of coffin-related images.
Yeah, and then people being carried away in carts. But then also on the seventh plate, which is on the bottom left-hand side, you can see people being buried. Now, I attended an interesting talk with somebody that was involved with Crossrail, and traditionally the image, and this is in part down to Daniel Defoe, his fictionalised account of the plague that, I mean, he was a five-year-old boy during the plague and he was in the city, but I, you know, can barely remember things that happened when I was five. So, you know, it's probably rooted in testimony of his relatives, but it is fictionalised. Mm-hmm. But he kind of puts forward this image of people kind of tumbling into plague pits and it all being disorderly. But what they found during the Crossrail excavations is that people are actually put... even though they were mass burial pits, they were actually put down in a uniform way. There was evidence that they'd had burial shrouds around them as well.
And you so can actually, burial shrouds and then put within a coffin and placed...
Some
them.
Put within coffins, but in an ordered way in terms of the positioning. And they were, you know, they weren't just... You didn't find arms and legs everywhere. They
Absolutely,
were just in neat lines.
So it wasn't this sort of, oh, bring out your dead, chuck them in a hole. Yeah, it was much more ceremonial than that. Much more. And the idea that actually they're being buried in consecrated ground. You can see the church there, and although they are big open pits, even in the image you can sort of see them lined up, can't you?
Yeah, you can see them, and you can also see this the image kind of supports the evidence that they've discovered during the Crossrail excavations. But the parish churchyards became too full at a certain point, so they did have to look for consecrated ground elsewhere. And that's how the new churchyard was born, actually, in the 16th century. But they used it again during the Great Plague, and many people found themselves buried there in the end. There's actually a very sad, broken remnant of a gravestone that was discovered during the dig that belonged to a little girl called Mary Godfrey, and she died in 1665 of plague, and her records are within the parish, her death records are within the parish records and show that she died of plague. And so we have that kind of material evidence that's lasted. So, you know, people were creating gravestones. It may have been created many years after the plague, who knows, but, you know, there was still respect for the dead. And actually, when you move on to the eighth image, you can see a funeral procession there. Now, this would have been a luxury for somebody to have an actual, you know, funeral, because people weren't allowed to attend funerals. That was part of the law, the plague orders. You weren't allowed to attend the funerals of your loved ones.
Of concern of contamination, people gathering together in a space. Gosh!
Yeah, and that was a very painful thing for the population at the time, because, of course, again, deeply religious society. There's one writer called Thomas Clarke who actually wrote a testimony from being in quarantine, which is the only one that that we have from that time. And he writes about how the fact that you weren't allowed to attend people's funerals was like a second death, because you didn't have those, you know, those traditions that would normally occur.
Well, there's all these associations of the idea of the salvation of the soul through the last rites.
Yeah.
The idea of, you know, again, witnessing the burial. It's a closure, as we can call it now.
Yeah.
But that's incredible. And again, I think it's one of the things we forget about with the amount of deaths you're talking about, 100,000 in such a short space of time. Society must have gone upside down, and any traditional burial practices, including this sort of very elaborate funereal ritual you can see here, must have gone out the window. So presumably this is fantastical then. It's
not. I mean, there would have been instances of these funerals taking place. There was one funeral of a captain of the Royal Navy. He died not of plague, but he died during plague time, and he was buried within a parish that was rife with plague at the time. The parish church was the place that his young daughter had been buried before, so he wanted to be buried there. His wife was not able to attend. None of his immediate family attended, but he did have people attend his funeral. Now, he didn't die from plague, but it was still, you know, a funeral that happened and people attended. So there were rare occasions when this did happen. On other occasions, people defied these plague orders and went to the funerals of their loved ones anyway, or, you know, there's instances in Pepys's diary of people escaping their houses, being shut up to go and follow the burial of their loved ones and stuff. So,
well, because there's the human instinct for grieving, but also, as you say, the religious implications of having to do this formally. So much must have been sped up. There must have been shortcuts taken just to dispose of the large numbers of bodies that were being.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a horrible thought. And what's so interesting talking to you, Rebecca, but also looking at these images, is how vividly it comes to life, actually. And we sort of hear these big words, Black Death, Plague, 1666, Great Fire, and they're big, iconic historical moments, but they're affecting people on such a deep human level and on a cultural level and on an ideological level that we take that for granted sometimes, how cataclysmic these things could be.
Yeah, and I think that's what drives my research. I love researching people, individuals. I love those stories. And when it comes to the Great Plague of 1665, you have so many individual stories. Like, one of the most heartbreaking things that I had to go through in researching the book and researching the plague was actually going through the parish burial registers, and you see the same surname cropping up again and again and again on the same pages until you have no one. It's literally written no one, child of X, you know, because the whole family has died and nobody knows the name of the child. And it's so sad. And, you know, 350 years separates us from what, 351, 352 actually now. No, it's 353. So anyway.
You lost a few years.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Oh, age, it gets us all. But, you know, so much time separates us from then. And but still, these stories are so, so raw. And it's a pleasure when you're a historian, and you will be fully aware of this, when you're able to find stories that have been, that have just been left for decades or hundreds of years, and you can pull them out and shine a light on them and actually give an extra bit of life to that person, if you know, if you can.
And I think that that's a trend that we're seeing increasingly in history, which I think is a very, very good thing. We're not just studying the big kings, queens, battles, events, dates. We're trying to get to human stories a lot more now, I think, in our research. And I mean, I'm so interested in what you're doing. It's such a pleasure to talk to you. We've talked at length, and I want to say a massive thank you. If people want to follow you on Twitter, how do they find you?
I am at Rebecca Radil on Twitter, and everything is actually on there. So, yeah, follow me. Please do.
And just give one more plug for your amazing book, because it is an amazing book.
Oh, thank you. It's 1666, Plague, War and Hellfire.
Yeah, you're such a star. I love the research you're doing, and I just want to keep listening out for more discoveries that you're coming up with. Such a pleasure talking to you, Rebecca.
Oh, thank you for having me.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.